I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
All right, let's do this. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, people who didn't see the Oscars like myself. I'll have to admit it, Riley. Didn't watch them. Couldn't watch them. You? No.
Of course not.
There's no watching them. I was in bed. My wife was up watching them. I told her to give me some highlights this morning when I left the apartment at 3. And she said, no, nothing, got nothing. But I do have, for you people out there that did not get to see the Oscars, I do have the rundown. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start? Let's do it like the Oscars. Let's go up from...
Wait a minute. You don't want to start with, like, costume design or something, do you?
Of course. I want to do best sound mixing. There's a lot of people out there that are like, come on, what about the sound editing? Huh? What about that? Visual effects.
How about short film live action?
There you go. What was that?
Wasp.
Okay, see? There was a few people out there just now when you said that, Riley, that went, no.
Yeah,
so, you know, these communities are small, but they're important. You know,
yeah.
These small live action reality short feature. What was it? Anyways, something like that. These are important to people. Animated feature, The Incredibles. Huh?
Okay.
I didn't know that was a separate category. I'm out of the loop. I had no idea. Foreign language film, The Sea Inside. That was about the guy, the quadriplegic guy, right?
Isn't that, yeah.
I missed that one. And I'm not condescending to foreign films. We were going to go see it the other night, my wife and I, but we didn't because we were tired. Okay? That's all. Adapted screenplay, Alexander Payne and Jim Taylor, Sideways, about time. I think it's the third time around for those cats.
Okay.
I knew Jim Taylor back in the day. Nice guy. Used to date a friend of my first wife's. Nice guy. Alexander Payne, I met him a couple times. Jim Taylor's a nicer guy. All right. Original screenplay. Charlie Kaufman, Michael Gondry, and Pierre Bismuth for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. See, I would have liked to have seen that award because I have no idea what Charlie Kaufman looks like, and I like the guy.
Hmm.
What do you got for best actress in a supporting role there?
Well, Cate Blanchett won that for The Aviator. That was...
she played Katharine Hepburn.
Yes, she played Katharine Hepburn, and that she beat out Sophie Okendo, who some people thought might win for Hotel Rwanda. Best actor in a supporting role, Morgan Freeman won for Million Dollar Baby over Alan Alda, Thomas Hayden Church, Jamie Foxx, and Clive Owen.
That's interesting because, like, it was a good role for him. You didn't see
Clive
the film.
Owen, sorry.
Clive Owen. It was a good role for him. You didn't see Million Dollar Baby, right?
No.
But I don't know if it was his best role, you know.
Morgan Freeman?
Yeah. I really liked him in The Unforgiven a lot.
Yeah, I did too.
You know, I mean, he was good in this, but I you know.
Not so
right.
much in Driving Miss Daisy, but
right.
hey, what the heck. Nobody's
so,
perfect.
Actor in a leading role. Jamie Foxx takes it over
yes.
Don Cheadle, Johnny Depp, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Clint Eastwood. You know, when I look at that lineup, I didn't see Hotel Rwanda, but I don't know. Johnny Depp was okay in that Finding Neverland, but enough discussion about that. We already knew all those things going into it. And Best Director, Clint Eastwood for Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah.
Which I think was a surprise because I thought that a lot of people
thought Scorsese.
They were going to throw him a bone for the movie that he shouldn't have been. You know, the movie he should have won for is behind him.
Yeah.
And there might be another one ahead of him. But Aviator, usually that doesn't make any difference. Sometimes these awards are just given to people like, he's been around a while.
Yeah.
And then it gets too long and they're like, give him a lifetime achievement. All right, Best Picture.
Million Dollar Baby.
How do you like that?
I don't think most people were surprised at that. Again, I haven't seen any of these films. I haven't seen Aviator, Neverland, Ray, or Sideways.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, the buzz on Million Dollar Baby seemed to be pretty heavy. It seemed like most of the Hollywood pundits had rated it a toss-up between Aviator and Million Dollar Baby.
Well, I'm okay with it. I'm not upset by it. I thought Aviator was a good movie. Finding Neverland certainly not. Ray not as an entire film. Sideways there was just no way. It was too small a movie. But Million Dollar Baby was surprising. It was interesting. It was dark. It was moving. It had all the right elements, and no happy ending.
Now, do you think that there's going to be
which
any...
Which is unusual, usually. They go for the happy
endings. They go for the happy endings. But do you think that there's going to be any backdraft on this? In other words, people... Because there were people who said that it was, you know, the ending was offensive to evangelicals or whatever. Do you think the fact that it won will now have the evangelicals and the Jim Dobsons of the world jumping up and saying, see, I told you those Hollywood liberal elitists, look at what they value. They valued this Million Dollar Baby film.
Well, I think what was the backlash about? It was about pro-euthanasia.
Yes.
It was about the fact that that she had nothing left to live for, and he helped her die because she wanted to die, which is not a very Christian thing, apparently, choosing to take your own life when there is no hope. They were trying to make a case that, you know, it was against quadriplegics who are trying to adapt to life with their illness as opposed to give up like this. Yeah, it was. I think it was kind of a lame trial balloon.
It was weak, and especially, you know, against Clint Eastwood, their guy for all these years, the guy who really, you know, took on the hippie movement in the early 70s with all those Dirty Harry movies.
Right, and it wasn't, I don't think it was what the film was really about. The film was about, you know, the darkness, you know, of the soul and these, you know, and these decisions everyone makes about, you know, relationships, about, you know, what life is built on. I just don't, it wasn't what the movie was really about. You know, it was about struggle and it was about challenging your past. But, you know, they tried to float it, and it didn't seem to stick, you know. I don't see how they can take a shot at Clint Eastwood. It's a great movie.
No, I don't think at this point they're in a position to take a shot at Clint Eastwood.
And Eastwood said it was a love story, which is a very amazing thing, because this is a guy that has this sort of, you know, undisclosed, painful schism in his heart with his daughter, who you never see. And he gets his second shot, you know, at life, you know, in terms of creating a relationship with somebody, you know, who, a surrogate daughter, who is Hilary Swank, who, you know, he fights off at first, but she's got this fighting spirit. And then at the end, you know, what, you know, the peace that is found at the end is very painful, it's very bittersweet, and it's very, it's profound, you know, and it's very human. And, you know, these Christian ideologues, the right-wing propagandists, they have a really hard time with things that resonate a humanity that might be sort of ambiguous.
Well, I don't know whether that's true, Mark. I mean, look at the number one movie of the weekend, which was backed by at least the black Christians, certainly black evangelicals, Diary of a Mad Black Woman. Now, this is an extraordinary event that this movie, which, by the way, only cost $5.5 million to make, took in better than 22 at the box office. This is a guy who comes from the black chitlin circuit, the black play chitlin, what they describe euphemistically as the chitlin circuit.
The chitlin circuit can apply to any form of entertainment, correct?
Yeah.
Comedy, music.
Comedy, music, but it's a specific circuit that developed in the late 1970s,
mm-hmm.
where people put these stage plays in different theaters across the country, and many people have made a whole bunch of money. Now, this guy, Tyler Perry, who made this series of plays.
Are they morality plays, all of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, most of them are morality plays, and many of them are tailored specifically to appeal to black church-going audiences, mm-hmm. because they'll travel in groups to go see these mm-hmm. plays. And they've made the plays. You know, they do the Beacon Theater, they'll sell out a whole weekend, 3,200-seat theater right here in New York. And I'm sure that many people in our other cities where we broadcast have seen these kinds of plays or heard about these kind of plays before. But this guy, Tyler Perry, was living hand-to-mouth just a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
Started doing these plays. They bombed in Atlanta, which is a hotbed of where a lot of them are launched. He managed to get the film made out of this play, and the film is the number one film at the box office. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I have no idea what it's about. Have not, you know, it just came out of nowhere. I haven't done the research. I would like to check out what it is, but I've always noticed that about black audiences in general, even when I first got hip to the black comedy scene, is that, you know, these were guys that I'd never heard of. The place was packed.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there is certainly a community sort of media outlet. I don't know how it works, but there are cats that, like, are, you know, secondary players. You know, they're just like, if a black comedy night appears somewhere, bam, the place is packed.
Because they have individual followings. And this is a tradition that goes back to Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song in the early 1970s, Melvin Van Peebles' film, which was screened in community centers when theaters wouldn't take it because it was X-rated.
Sure. Even the Red Fox Party Record.
Oh. Every black family has
exactly.
to do it. Oh.
There's a whole legacy to that. Now, let's speaking about church going, the president of a 400-member congregation in Wichita, Kansas, has just been found out to be the BTK killer, who was accused of killing 10 people in the Wichita area from 1974 to 1991. Goes against the sort of, how come the publicity isn't the same? If this guy was a Satanist, man, we would be hearing about it in every news outlet over and over and over again, of him representing some sort of downside of morality. But when it's a guy that's just a straight arrow kind of dude in the community, I wonder how they're going to handle this in the press. We'll talk about it when we come back at 16 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Monday morning. Monday morning, man. Monday morning.
Yes, it is.
I'll tell you, I never knew what Monday meant until I had a gig like this. I had a good weekend with my wife. Today is my one-year anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We made it a year. Tonight we're going to the diner where we used to meet clandestinely.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's a symbolic anniversary dinner. Very, it's going to be nice. You know what
this
I mean?
This should be fun.
Oh, boy. I'm going to get all choked up.
There you go.
We had a weird, I had some family in town. I'm not allowed to say who because it might blow his cover, but I had some family in town. And, man, we just did some serious, over-the-top eating. Just crazy.
Really?
Went to the Second Avenue Deli. Went to this place, Fresco, on Saturday night. It's got an entire hallway filled with Regis Philbin pictures.
Oh, wow.
It's just like Regis at this table, Regis at that table, Donald Trump and Regis at this table. It was one of those restaurants, but it was great. And we went to theater. Maybe I'll talk about that later. But let's now talk about a different type of family man, shall we? This guy who calls himself the BTK killer, which is a bind, torture, and kill, 59-year-old Dennis Rader, a church-going family man. He's still alleged, but it's starting to look pretty much.
He allegedly confessed.
But dig this, a Cub Scout leader, a dog catcher for the trim suburb of Park City, a church leader. You know, this is a guy, this is the same state where, you got Attorney General Phil Klein who does everything he can to sort of, wrangle, the right to life. This is where the right to life army is, the Christo-fascist zombie brigades of the neocon death cult. And there you get this guy that's presenting himself as a model citizen. Those neighbors didn't really like him. But, sometimes you wonder what is the sort of screaming id of the sort of standard American conservative guy. This guy, they're going to, I think that the administration is rallying to have him put in Guantanamo because at least he can work there.
You know what it is, Mark? When it comes to, if you look back on Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, look at these kinds of serial killers.
Bundy was like that.
Yeah.
Gacy.
They blend in very well. They're not people that are threatening to folks in any way. They're very, much tight-knit. Many of them go to church on Sunday. But they have, underneath all this, a very, very serious problem. And society, I think, very deliberately treats them as isolated incidents. Everybody, when they go to interview folks, he may have been an evil guy about, dog poop or whatever his problem was. But generally, people are expressing shock that he is the guy that is alleged to have done these things.
Uh-huh.
I mean, these are 10 people we're talking about.
Yeah, and the serial killers have, they do have similar psychological profiles. But and one of them is that this guy was really, seemed to want to get caught, was baiting them to catch him, was getting off on the whole idea that he was one step ahead of the law. But the bottom line that I find interesting is that This is something that this guy was doing behind this. Not Bundy was, he was affable and smart, and I think that Gacy was involved in the community.
He was a Cub Scout leader, same as this guy.
Yeah. But it's just, what does that say, though? What does it say about sort of traditional family guy, the sort of church-going conservative family guy? Does it say anything about them, or am I reading into it? Is it wrong to assume that there are some sort of deeply repressed subconscious problems on behalf of a lot of these type of people?
Well, more than the society, or certainly
something I want
that
to be true.
That cohort of church-going Americans would care to admit. There are more people that have these kind of dark sides to their personalities. And it's why the serial killers, in many instances, get away with it for so long. I mean, look, Eileen Wuornos, who was the first female serial killer of note who was executed some years ago, she was kind of sort of a dead giveaway, at least in terms of law enforcement, even though she murdered a whole bunch of people. If you go back over a lot of these serial killers from the past, they were misfits, they were oddballs, they were this, they were that, they were the other. But if you start looking now, you're seeing these pillars of the community. And that's not to, you know, make people paranoid about dealing with folks, because that can come with this too. But when you see the kind of shock and amazement on people's faces, him? No, it couldn't be him.
Well, there's a denial. You know, it's the same, you know, when, you know, somebody has, you know, is with somebody. It's a proximity thing. It's almost like when somebody is having an affair. You know, the wife doesn't know because they're too close. They don't want to know. They're never going to think this. But if you think about the profile, you got a church-going, conservative guy that works for the city, that, you know, that is sort of a control freak, and underneath he's hiding this dark past of killing people in the most heinous way possible. It sort of reflects a little on, I just realized that our president is much like that. President George Bush, you know, is, you know, has got blood on his hands from, like, you know, up to how many people did he kill in Texas with the capital punishment? You know, dozens. Right now he's, you know, killing, you know, thousands of Iraqi civilians. He's killing American soldiers, and he won't go to their funerals. There's a denial that, you know, to a lot of people, George Bush is a sort of tough love, straight talking, you know, level guy, you know, that makes them feel protected and strong. But you know what? If you really look at what's teeming behind that guy's mind and what that guy's responsible for, he's not unlike this guy in Kansas, except this guy did it for fun. Yeah, I don't know that George Bush is doing it for fun, you know, but if he is, there's no difference between him and the serial killer, just numbers.
Well, Dennis Rader, is being held on $10 million bond, and right now they're saying that in terms of the 10 killings that they're looking at him for, he would not face the death penalty, but now there are sources telling, I believe it's the Associated Press, yes, that they are looking into tying him to three other killings, one of which took place after Kansas reinstituted the death penalty in 1994, which would make him eligible.
Wow. Yeah, from what I understand, he's not facing the death penalty, as I said before, because Alberto Gonzalez wants to hire him to do some work. They might outsource him to Egypt or Jordan or, you know, one of the other places where they do that kind of stuff with a certain amount of freedom. Abu Ghraib is, of course, the cat's out of the bag there.
Oh, absolutely. We've got the Palm Pilot coming up, and we're going to talk a little health care when we come back here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning,
it's
Mark Maron.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Monday morning. We're doing it. We're starting the week. Ramon just came by wearing, handcuffs. One wrist had a handcuff and the other one was dangling, and he looked, you know, a little beat up but happy. I don't know. But he brought us Condoleezza Rice's Palm Pilot. You know, the Condi was, you know, speaking to the troops last week, and there was a little concern about the appropriateness or the power of her outfit. So I guess this is in relation to that. 4:30 a.m. Prepare clothing ensemble for world domination. If they won't love me, they will fear me. 5 a.m. Checklist. Black leather hip boots with 4-inch heels. Black military jackets with brass buttons. Black latex underpants, cape, mask. I feel pretty. Pretty damn powerful. 5:30 a.m. Plug into Matrix. Fly through cyberspace at light speed. Wreak havoc. Organize machines to crush human rebellion. Superhero name? Neo. Con. D. 7 a.m. Breakfast. Half a grapefruit. Decaf. 9 a.m. Replace pitiful human flesh with machine parts. 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Intimidate world. 7 p.m. Eat dinner alone. So alone. Superheroes always eat alone. Wow, big day. Hey, look, folks, I want to tell you later in the show we have Sam Rosenfeld from American Prospect Magazine to talk about the congressional agenda for the week, and Stephen Cook from the Council of Foreign Relations. is going to we're going to get into a little bit about the new government in Iraq, about what's going on in Egypt, and maybe about what's going on right now. Pretty heavy news out of Baghdad. Mark Riley.
Right, Mark. Well over 100 people, depending on who you talk to, as few as 110, as many as 125, have been killed as a suicide car bomber drove into a crowd of people outside a government medical office. This is in the town of Hilla, which is about 55 miles south of Baghdad. These were folks, Iraqi police recruits. This is a common thread with a lot of the insurgency now, going after police recruits for the Iraqi government. These were people who were lined up outside the building waiting to be given physicals.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the second car bomb exploded about 15 miles to the north in Musayib, which is there were reports of wounded there, but no other details. This is a day after 8 people were killed and 2 injured when a bomb exploded inside a municipal building in northern Iraq. Again, the insurgency is aimed at trying to make it very, very dangerous for people to work for either the interim government that's there now or the incoming government that will, I assume, be formed after the National Assembly meeting.
That must have been one hell of a packed bomb. I mean, that's a lot of lives, man. It's so aggravating because it's stuff like you think that after a certain point the Americans, you know, want to leave and that there's talk about this new government asking the Americans to leave, yet these guys keep hitting their own people, you know, to deter them from, you know, from signing on to the American presence. But if they keep doing it this way, the Americans are never going to leave.
Well, they're hitting these Iraqis as collaborators with the Americans. The Iraqi police, the Iraqi security forces, these people are seen by the insurgency, rightly or wrongly, as being collaborators with the U.S. government. Now, the side part of that is that the more they do this, the longer the U.S. troops stay, and the bigger the straw dog for them to attack.
And now, you know, all that talk about, you know, Iraq's ex-Baathists, the Sunni Baathists that are part of this insurgency, along with jihadists and just basically disgruntled, angry Iraqis, they're assuming that a lot of these guys might have been real, you know, operatives within the government of Saddam because a couple of days ago they hit an oil pipeline. These people know where these things are, and this type of strategy is very precise. But clearly, it's not getting better there. It seems to be getting worse. I mean, this is a big couple of bombs here.
Well, what you were talking about just now in terms of the oil pipeline.
Yeah.
What they did was hit the oil pipelines that serviced Baghdad.
Mm.
They did not hit the oil pipelines that were for exporting the oil. So in other words, they're not hitting where the money comes from. They're hitting the oil that was going to try and alleviate Iraq's glaring infrastructure problems. Same thing here. They're hitting the police. They're hitting the people that they see as being part and parcel of trying to make Iraq function in some way, and particularly when you're talking about, for example, the city of Baghdad. So you're talking now about, you know, 200-some-odd people having to be taken to the hospital, over 100 people killed. It's going to be interesting to see, because right now there's a vacuum. If anybody's going to respond to this in any substantive way, it's going to have to be Iyad Alawi. They haven't chosen, the National Assembly has not yet met to choose the president and the cabinet ministers that will eventually choose the prime minister. So right now, it's on Alawi.
So he's going to have to manage this thing and see what happens.
He's going to have to respond.
Well, obviously, it blows me away that this thing is getting stronger, that there's all this press coming out, that there are these great things about the democratic elections in Iraq. There are people like Thomas Friedman talking about how, you know, Democrats and progressives, you know, have to get on board now, have to start to sort of like, you know, say, hey, this is a good thing. This was a liberal cause to bring democracy, you know, to foreign countries. This was something Harry Truman talked about. This is part of why America is great. So there's a sort of, you know, a lot of that kind of talk coming out of, you know, I guess, you know, Friedman is not, he's a, you know, what is he, a moderate?
He's a moderate Democrat.
Right, a moderate Democrat that, you know, now it's time for people like me and you or people from our ilk to start saying, all right, let's put the past behind us. There were no WMDs. There were, you know, all this was built on a lie. 100,000 Iraqis may be dead, 1,500 Americans, 7,000 injured Americans. But put all that aside, now we have to focus on the fact that this is something that Democrats have wanted. This is a liberal cause to bring democracy to foreign countries. And I don't know how I feel feel about that, especially in light of that there's so much unresolved stuff going on there. There's still dozens and dozens, hundreds of people dying, you know, on a weekly basis.
The question for progressives, moderates, and even right-wingers alike is who will deal finally with this insurgency? Will it be the American troops that are there that have not yet dealt with it? Or will it be some form of Iraqi security force or police? And how heavy-handed will the new Iraqi government allow that security force to be in crushing this insurgency?
And but yeah, and also, doesn't the real question come down to, you know, if that's the case, and I agree with you that that's the case, I mean, what is to stifle? How do we know how long this is going to go on? How do we know how organized they are? What if the reality is more of a, you know, a Palestinian-Israeli situation where this is a sort of, you know, seemingly endless civil war situation that never gets fully resolved?
Well, it could actually, as we speak, be degenerating into that. But the flip side is that maybe an Iraqi security force would deal with the insurgents the same way Hosni Mubarak in Egypt dealt with an insurgency of fundamentalists there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, you break into people's houses, you shoot them, you shoot their families if they get in the way, you crush the insurgency. And I mean an all-out push to crush the insurgency, which means that you have to scare them, all right? Because you're now dealing with folks that not, obviously are not afraid of death.
Right.
The guy who drove that car that killed all these, he wasn't afraid to die. He did, most likely did.
But do you think that, you know, in a sort of publicized way they probably already are on some level, but that tactic that you're quoting as Mubarak's tactic in killing people's families, threatening them, basically operating in the same mental space that the insurgency operates in.
Exactly.
Will the Americans, you know, be able to do that? I'm sure they're doing it already, but will they be able to do that publicly, and is that what we really want from our soldiers?
We don't want our fingerprints on that kind of thing. That's why they're looking at things like the Salvador option. That's why they're looking at special forces to handle these sorts of things.
Bringing the guys that are like, we didn't even see them. Like the American soldiers on the ground. These guys were so special and so quick that we didn't even know who they are.
Yeah, so that they have some level of what is called in politics speak, plausible deniability.
It just seems to me that, you know, once we do pull out of there, and if we do pull out of there soon, that, you know, the possibilities of it turning into just some sort of strange civil war, like regional bloodbath, with no holds barred is very high.
Well, in terms of the insurgents, there are no holds barred. When they blow up this many people, they're pretty much saying, look, this is what we are committed and pledged to do. The real flip side of this is going to be, how does the government react, whether it's the American government? And we've seen the American government essentially sit back. Have you heard anybody talk about Negroponte's replacement as American ambassador to Iraq yet?
Mm-mm.
Not a word, have we? Haven't heard boo about it.
Yeah.
So who's in charge over there?
What's going on?
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about, we're going to come back to this later in the hour. I'd be curious to hear maybe, well, we won't do it now. But it's just an interesting problem. You know, about, you know, what happens now, you know, in Iraq, and how do progressives and liberals start to deal with it? Do we stay? We'll deal with this later in the hour,
yeah.
And maybe we'll address some of our listeners. But we're going to come back and get into this healthcare thing, because it seems to me that a lot of people, Bush has a big meeting with the governors of the 50 states today.
Yeah, not everybody's on the ranch.
Yeah, and it's interesting because also some presidential hopefuls are coming out of this as well. It's 44 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air, and online, morningsedition.com, Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
You.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. So tell me about this, Riley. Tell me about this meeting of governors. Is this a yearly thing? Does this happen every year that the president gets to come down and meet with the governors of every state?
Well, the governors meet. The National Governors Association does meet. The president does not go every year that I know of. They probably, I mean, it's in D.C.
Yeah.
If he's in D.C., I guess it makes perfect
sense.
But
this is important because he's trying to get these guys to sell the Social Security. He's trying to get everybody to sell Social Security. And apparently, a lot of people are having trouble selling Social Security. And this was primarily about Medicaid. And this guy, this Governor Mark R. Warner of Virginia, a Democrat, basically said, you know, shut up about Social Security. That's a moot point. That's not going anywhere. But Medicaid is going to be a real problem.
Well, he's not the only one, Mark. Mm-hmm. There are some Republican governors who believe exactly the same thing. They like, in general, the idea of the privatization. They don't like the president getting into a spitting match with the AARP.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't, you know, the private accounts thing they may be down with. But they, as you very correctly point out, do not believe that is the most pressing problem. They're saying fixing Medicaid is the most pressing problem. And when you start looking at some of the cuts that these guys are going to have to make, I'm sorry, men and women mm-hmm. are going to have to make, because Medicaid, according to many of these governors, is underfunded in their state. In other words, the federal contribution to Medicaid, because it's a split contribution. The states kick in and the feds kick in. Well, that federal government contribution is shrinking, and people are a little nervous about it. In fact, he's proposing $60 billion in cuts over the next 10 years, starting in his 2006 budget. 26 states already facing budget deficits would be forced to absorb another $32 billion worth of additional shortfalls. And ironically enough, many of the states hardest hit are states that went for Bush and also have Republican governors.
Isn't that interesting? That, you know, I wonder if this will wake them up to the mistake they made during the election. It's more than 50 million Americans rely on Medicaid, which pays for one-third of all births, covers more than one-fourth of all children, and finances care for two-thirds of nursing home residents. And the states that are having some trouble, Florida, Tennessee, Georgia, Mississippi, they're having trouble for pretty specific reasons. North Carolina, Nebraska, Colorado, Alabama. I mean, you know, I guess in Tennessee, this state is slated to lose over $300 million in discretionary grants, according to Families USA. The budget would cost Tennessee $1.2 billion over 10 years in Medicaid funding, affecting thousands of Tennessee children and senior citizens. $1.2 billion over 10 years.
Well, what's happened here, Mark,
yeah.
is that the original intent of Medicaid was to cover the poorest families in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It has expanded, as you very correctly point out, to be a lot more than that. Two-thirds of all births, one-fourth of all children, two-thirds of all nursing home residents. Medicaid, according to lawmakers now, was never really intended to cover all of these people that in that kind of comprehensive fashion. So what you see these governors doing is saying, look, you know, you're going to force cuts on us. We are now going to have to tighten eligibility. For example, in the state of Colorado, they decided to remove legal immigrants from full Medicaid coverage 2 years ago. They signed the law. It was upheld by a federal judge. And then the state House of Representatives tentatively voted to restore the coverage for thousands of legal immigrants. The measure still has to go to the state Senate for approval. So you see that there are people who are reacting, lawmakers, state lawmakers, who are reacting very badly to the idea that Bush is cutting all of this funding. $60 billion.
That's unbelievable. In Mississippi, Governor Haley Barbour signed off on a plan to eliminate coverage for 65,000 elderly and disabled residents. 65,000. Just cut them off. Medicaid provides health insurance for about one-quarter of Mississippi residents. The cuts are currently being challenged in court and have yet to take effect. That's, you know, the baffling thing is, what are these people going to do, Riley? What are they going to just, you know, what are they going to do? Either they're going to adapt or die. I mean, and then when you put this up against, you know, bankruptcies, medical bankruptcies, just how many people, when put in a position to pay for their own medical treatment,
yeah.
even if they're insured. I mean, look at these numbers. Almost 1.5 million American families filed for bankruptcy in 2001. 54.5% of them filed for bankruptcy due to illness and medical bills. 2.2 million people, okay, were affected by medical bankruptcy in 2001. More than 75% of them had insurance at
yes.
the onset of illness. At the onset of illness. So these health care companies, you know, will cut off people's treatment if it gets too dire. I mean, then if these Medicaid cuts go in, I mean, basically they're legislating or allow these budget cuts are literally killing people. They're killing people.
When you talk about debilitating illnesses, Mark, you talk about people, for example, in medical bankruptcies. The median income was $24,500, but more than half of these people in bankruptcy had attended college, and more than half of them owned their own homes, which I assume they might have been in jeopardy of losing. That's probably why they declared the bankruptcy in the first place. And you have the Bush administration at the same time pushing law to tighten the ability to declare personal bankruptcy. So you see, you have on top of all of this, you have people saying, well, we're going to limit your ability to even declare bankruptcy.
So that's in the Congress right now, so we'll talk to Rosenfeld about that later.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and the amazing thing also is that, you know, these are people like me, Riley. These are people like you. And
yeah.
This could happen to anybody. You know, this is not some sort of, you know, freak event or some sort of event that's limited to just, you know, people with nothing. You know, not that that makes it any more important or not. I mean, the people who are really compromised, that are really financially compromised, that are really poor, are literally being told that, you know, you adapt or die. You know, we have faith-based initiatives. Go to church if you're really sick. At least get straight with God before you check out.
Well, I mean, look at the situation in Arkansas. Arkansas's got a Republican governor, Mike Huckabee, vice chairman of the National Governors Association.
Yeah.
Now, in his state, there are 717,000 people on Medicaid out of a total population of 2.7 million. You know what that translates to? 1 in 4.
Wow.
That is an incredible statistic if you think about it. 717,000 people out of 2.7 million are on Medicaid. And any kind of tightening of eligibility requirements, any kind of tinkering with that program to make up that federal shortfall is going to mean some of those 717,000 people will get pushed off the Medicaid rolls.
But am I wrong in saying, I mean, okay, so after that, am I wrong in saying that basically they're cutting these people loose in the most vulnerable position they could be in? They're denying them the possibility of even having hope when they do get sick. And, then, you know, this ties right in with some of that stuff we were reading about the prison system. I mean, you know, when we get into that, maybe over the top of the next hour,
yeah,
we'll talk about that a little bit, because it seems to me that all health care is eventually going to look like the type of health care you see in the prison system in this country.
Very true. What we're going to see is a social Darwinism brought to health care.
Adapt or die.
Yeah. That's going to mean more and more people are going to live in poor health. More and more people will die prematurely in the black community. It means that those numbers of the disparity, the gap between white and black life expectancy, is going to continue to expand.
I see the scam, man. They're trying to develop a completely almost indestructible type of poor person, so when they're fighting in wars all around the planet, they'll at least be able to have people to send.
Yeah, warriors.
How else? Exactly.
Warriors
with no money. Exactly.
Exactly. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Sam Rosenfeld, you mentioned that earlier, about Congress, and we've got a whole lot more for you, including the Morning Remembrance here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Weather.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning, everybody. It's Monday. Shut the door of the studio. Come on, shut the door of the studio. I can see people walking by. Everyone can hear me out there in the hallway, and I can hear them. Sorry, folks, I'm letting you in. I'm letting you in on the process here. Thank you, Clutch Larson, doing what he does best in the moment, man.
He
just flipped me off. No, I didn't mean it that way. I meant you were being clutch. It was a clutch situation, you know. You flipped me off, dude. He flipped me off. And then, of course, he said, I was wrong. All right, now, that was very nice. Very nice of him to say that. We're in the middle of something here, Riley. We're in the middle. I want to say good morning, everybody. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Tim, the librarian's on the board. Kayla's on vacation. I don't know, you know, Caleb just, you know, he's taking a vacation. I said, where are you going? He said, I'm not going anywhere.
I'm just bouncing from here.
Yeah. Clutch Larson's in the booth. Pashman, Son of Lewis and Linda Pashman of New Jersey is out in the night. It's our intern, Elon's last day.
Yeah, I know. I heard that.
Yeah, we might bring him in here later in the show to figure out what his future plans are. P.W. McDonald, I don't know where.
How many segments is that going to take?
That should take about a half a segment. Then move on.
I'm sorry.
No. That could take a whole segment if we include Dungeon and Dragons game. if we could talk about what his future plans are in German board games. So that actually could go into the next show. So here we go. Let's moving back into healthcare. They are now, you know, I guess Bush is looking to begin phase two of his restricting victims' rights legislation, whereas he's going to start to, now that he's moved all class action suits into the federal court, can no longer do it on a state level, correct?
Yes.
That which means that the federal courts are less likely to give the type of awards that state courts are, and also less likely to hear all the cases the state courts are. That was phase one of restricting victims' rights and allowing corporations to run ramshack. What is it? Run ramshod?
Rampant.
Run rampant over whatever they want without paying the price for it, unless just including the lawsuits into their bottom line, $250,000 caps.
That's the next step.
The caps, but they're going to start with malpractice lawyers. They're going to start with medical malpractice. Now, before we get exactly into this, I just want to say that that analysts say, okay, that medical errors are estimated to be responsible for 45,000 to 98,000 deaths a year, more than those caused by breast cancer, AIDS, or motor vehicles accidents. And that's according to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. Okay, 45,000 to 98,000 deaths a year because of medical errors.
Now, at the same time that's going up, the fact of the matter is that the trend in payments for malpractice claims against doctors and other medical professionals is going down.
Mm.
In fact, by 8.9%, a nationwide total of $4.6 billion. This is according to data compiled by the Health and Human Services Department, which, of course, the head of which is appointed by Bush.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a government agency saying that, in fact, payment on malpractice claims is going down.
And also, it's important to know that, you know, there are some doctors who believed that, you know, if they did their part in supporting, you know, Bush's policies, that their insurance, their malpractice insurance would go down. It did not. That's because malpractice insurance is not determined by the cost of lawsuits, which really only accounts for 2% of the medical costs. You know, overall, that's a big lie. It's a sham. The truth of the matter is that prices get jacked up by insurance companies, by HMO corporations, that they determine what the price is just on their own volition, whether their own investments need to be bolstered or whether they're hurting.
Well, see, that's the thing that people don't understand, I guess, about the way the insurance companies work.
Mm-hmm.
They invest the money that they get.
Mm-hmm.
If their investments are not working out real well for them, they will increase premiums.
But these doctors got screwed on this, and a lot of them are now coming around to the other side and start to realize that, hey, maybe it isn't such a bad idea to have lawsuits that protect patients. I mean, everyone makes mistakes, fine, but there's got to be some way of correcting, you know, the errors made around behavior within the hospitals, behavior within the HMO system. And the only way you can correct these, you know, entities is by having the power to bring legal action against them on behalf of someone who's been done wrongly to.
Well, see, if you want to see the future of Bush's plan in terms of this malpractice, all you have to do is look at the state of California, where they already have $250,000 cap on individual pain and suffering. And you know who ends up losing out? Children and the elderly. Because, see, there is still no limit on lost wages, economic benefits, that sort of thing. And, of course, who are the two populations that comes least into play with? Children, whose economic potential is still yet in formation, and seniors and the elderly, who really have a relatively short life expectancy. Therefore, you can't say that they're going to lose a whole bunch of money.
And also on the other side of that, Mark Riley, you get a kid who loses his arm or has some sort of, you know, organ problem. I mean, you know, $250,000, you know, flat out. I mean, what about treatment? What about prosthesis? What about, you know, adapting that kid into the world? What if that kid needs medical attention for the rest of his life? What are those? Where do you get that?
Well, medical expenses are included in Bush's plan. In other words, there is no limit on medical expenses.
Okay.
If it's a situation where a child is involved in some kind of cataclysmic event. However, in California, the effect has been some of those kids, not all, but some of those kids really do not get the kind of, because the insurers will look at, well, what is the future economic potential for example, a Mexican kid born in East Los Angeles? and they start, you know, the guy with the actuarial table, they're not going to look at that kid the same way they look at a rich kid who grew up in Pacific Palisades, for example.
Okay, hey,
the
look,
future economic.
We got a call from somebody who's listening to us out in California about exactly what you're talking about. Joanna in Concord, California. Good morning. What's on your mind, Joanna?
Good morning, Mark and Mark. What they're proposing to do on the med malpractice, they've done that here, of course, already.
We're just talking about that.
Yeah, and in workers' comp here in California, thanks to this Arnold coming in here, they just revamped workers' comp, and the employers were all for it because they thought they would lower the insurance premium.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't lowered them at all because part of the equation is not to regulate the insurance companies, because the insurance companies say, if you regulate us, we'll leave. So they've actually got everybody in a catch-22. Now they're making these record profits.
Right.
50 to 650%.
Oh, my God.
The premiums have not gone down, and it's been so difficult because I represent injured workers in California Workers' Comp. We have had in Northern California three people kill themselves because they couldn't get treatment within the last 6 months.
Oh, my God. That's awful.
This is what it's come to. So this is just another one of their scams. And notice how hot...
To support the insurance companies. The insurance companies...
Well, yeah, of course. That's where they're getting their money from.
That's right. That's right. Thank you, Joanna. That's a horrendous story. That, you know, see, they get the workers and the employers stuck into a catch-22, and they get them spinning around like that, you know, not having any choices, and the insurance company just reaps the benefits off their deaths. Three people commit suicide because they're stuck in a situation they can't get out of. Their health is compromised, and there's no hope. You know, and that's, you know, that was, there's your alternative to personal bankruptcy. Okay, which they're going to try and stifle. There's your alternative to, you know, the fact that 54.5% of the bankruptcies filed in this country are due to illness and medical bills that can't be met.
You know, I would at least give them some credit if, as is the case in some states across the country, they tied a cap to an actual reduction in costs.
Mm.
In other words, if the insurer said, okay, well, we're going to reduce premiums by X amount or X percentage in exchange for a cap, say, of $1.5 million on pain and suffering, maybe that's something you can negotiate. But the Bush administration is not talking, at this point anyway, about any kind of a guaranteed reduction in premium costs.
Mm.
You know, I mean, if you say that this is going to make things better, then why not guarantee it?
Well, you know, it's a good question, and also, you know, what it might look like is, you know, I swear to God, Riley, if these people get caps and the insurance companies and people that practice bad medicine, you know, get the upper hand, it's not going to look unlike the prison medical system, which we're going to talk about along with the Oscars after this break. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil.
In 3 hours or less,
Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Thank God I get to go to therapy this week. Man, it's been weeks. Oh, I was sick, and then my therapist was out of town. Oh, my God. The dreams are stacking up. Here's last night's dream diary. I'm at the Oscars, and some stick figure in a gold dress is up on stage thanking ICM and her manager and a nutritionist and Deepak Chopra. Suddenly, I see her lips moving, but no sound is coming out, and then I hear this booming male voice. Our annual Hollywood Secret Agenda meeting will now come to order. Here are the recommendations from the Supreme Council. Please integrate these into your work in the next coming year, but not in an obvious way that makes it look like we have an agenda. Number one, indulge the tweeners. This is a huge demographic group, is easily distracted, plenty of disposable income, the products of an inferior education system. Parents should always be portrayed as meddling fools. Rebellion should be always equated with shopping and a flat stomach. Use untested teen stars whenever possible. The younger they are, the less we have to pay them. No one should be hanging around after age 24 or so. Use them and lose them. Horror movies and video game adaptations are best playing on the tweener's short attention span, their casual bloodlust, and their emotional detachment, all of which we created. Get them hooked and keep them hooked. People, P.S., you're doing a great job. Number two, 90% of all content we produce should take place in blue state cities or in space or in the Shire. Red states are flyover country. Punish them for November 2nd. Three, interracial buddy comedies are good business, especially when white guys talk like hip-hop gangsters and try to dance. Hilarious. Just make sure no black men and black women kiss each other. Four, fat people are funny. Keep a couple around for laughs and make sure no fat men and fat women ever kiss each other. That implies they have feelings. Five, gays love cartoons. Kids love cartoons. Whenever possible, slip gay code into your animated feature. America's kids are getting gayer by the minute, and we have you to thank. This concludes our meeting. Until next year, remember, tell no one what you've heard here tonight. Now relax and go back to masturbating your gigantic egos. I woke up and my bed was filled with Irving Thalberg, who's been dead a long time, which was scary.
It must have been.
All right, man. So let's blast through these. Best actress in a supporting role, Kate Blanchett, The Aviator, as Katharine Hepburn.
Yes.
Actor, Morgan Freeman, Million Dollar Baby, beat out Alan Alda, Thomas Hayden Church, Jamie Foxx, Clive Owen. Thomas Hayden Church was excellent. So was Alan Alda, actually. Actress in a leading role, Riley, you got it?
Actress in a leading role went to Hilary Swank for Million Dollar Baby. Now, did you say that Morgan Freeman was, actor in supporting role?
Yes.
Best supporting.
He's good. He was good in that. Not as good.
Well, not as good as Unforgiven. Yeah. Not as good as Unforgiven.
It's hard to qualify. He's a great actor, and he did have a prosthetic fake eye in this, which always adds a little something. It's always a little creepy when somebody has, like, one of those, fake eyes. Even when Rob Schneider did it in that horrendous Adam Sandler movie, 100 First Dates or whatever it was called, when he had the fake eye, it undermined the comedy because it's creepy.
Wow.
I'm not judging anybody who has one of these, but, it's a little off-putting. And I thought Morgan played it very well.
Now, I guess you never watched Peter Falk, huh?
Yeah, well, his was like a glass eye, and that just sort of, it stayed still while the other one ran around. Now, this one had that weird, the white film over it, which is heavy, man.
That's sinister.
Yeah. But now, all of a sudden, because, I get emails from people, it's like, if this is a situation with you, we're not making fun of you or your handicap, but it's a little heavy in the Morgan Freeman role in Million Dollar.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm backpedaling, and I'm never going to get out
of it. No, it's, you know what it is? It's the way Hollywood portrays this sort of
thing. The weird white film
over the eye.
It doesn't work. All right, the Million Dollar Baby won Best Picture. Oh, my God.
Yes, and Clint Eastwood won Best Director for Million Dollar Baby.
And the best actor, of course, was
Jamie Foxx in Ray.
Which I thought he did a great job. I have not seen Don Cheadle in Hotel Rwanda. I do think that over Johnny Depp, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Clint Eastwood, Jamie Foxx was right up there. I really liked Clint Eastwood a lot in his role in Million Dollar Baby. But it was Jamie's year, and that's the way it goes. So now let's get into this story coming off of some of the medical stuff we were talking about, Riley, and about the compromising of the medical industry. If they do allow for malpractice caps, if they do allow caps in all lawsuits, then it seems to me that there's no end to a couple of things, how greed and incompetence will take over the medical industry.
Well, sooner or later, someone will start adding up whether or not it makes more sense. And, I hate to put it this way, but, facts are facts. Sooner or later, those actuarial tables will start comparing whether or not, allowing someone to die at the hands of someone's mistake is going to cost less than actually treating the person.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about what happens if Medicaid evolves the way they say it's going to evolve economically, if they keep making Medicare cuts, if they keep, people keep having to, bankrupt themselves in order just to, get the medical treatment they need. This adapt or die, legislation, basically, is what it is. Policy. Adapt or die policy. Darwinism. Is that when you have the jails that we're going to start talking about this about health care in the jails, is that you literally have a population of people that, most people will write off.
Yes.
Right? Not unlike poor people or not unlike almost anybody that isn't them or their family. So, but what you really see in action here, because of the way the medical industry specifically is operating in these prisons in upstate New York and elsewhere, is that they don't care about these people and they're taking advantage of them.
Well, what's happening is these folks saw a few years ago, in many cases about a decade ago, a niche. The government wanted to get out of providing health care to inmates. Why? Because inmates are disproportionately suffering from HIV and AIDS. Inmates are disproportionately suffering from mental illnesses. Most inmates are quite certainly don't want to be in prison.
Right.
So it's a very, very difficult population to provide medical care for. The government got tired of it, and suddenly all these different organizations, private organizations, stepped in to fill the breach. One of them, the largest, is Nashville-based Prison Health. They are the ones, they have a contract here in New York City worth $254 million over the next 3 years to deal with the New York City prison system. And that is despite having several people end up dying on their watch and in their responsibility in other prisons in New York State.
We'll get to that later, obviously. Yeah, but we're going to talk to our guest, Sam Rosenfeld, after this about what's going on in Congress in relation to bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy,
probably.
Yeah.
It's Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. Morning Sedition. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition. Don't be stupid. Come on, it feels like thinking. Here we go. We know a lot of people out there out of work and spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads or monster.com. We want to help. We want to help be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here is our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. Well, you know, I don't know if you heard, but Laura Bush fired the White House chef of 11 years. And sure enough, here's an ad for a chef. Actually, it says, cook wanted. A private residence in Washington, D.C. is looking for someone to prepare meals. The ideal applicant will be able to serve sophisticated entrees for the discriminating palates of visiting dignitaries and still throw down vittles for a husband and wife suffering under the willful delusion of being just plain folks. You will be serving meals to leaders from all over the globe who are coming to confer with your employer. Many of them will be severely nauseated by the time they get to dinner. This position requires an individual with rare patience and fortitude. For example, you must not have a bad reaction if your employers request a bottle of ketchup with any and every meal. Along similar lines, if your employer's daughters are visiting, you must be discreet if bottles of cooking sherry start disappearing. Please, be prepared to rename any dish or food item with a French-sounding name. One other thing, applicants must know the Heimlich maneuver.
Oh,
ha, ha, ha. Heimlich. Funny. Okay. Here we go. I have not made one of those into the garbage.
No, you did, actually. You did earlier this morning. The first one you threw,
bang.
You threw it, didn't even look at it. It went in.
That's how good I am. I'm like nothing came. Here we go. Our guest, he's a frequent guest on our show. He covers Congress on the website of the American Prospect. He's in Washington, D.C. Sam Rosenfeld, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Morning.
How you doing down there, Sam? You all right?
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
Okay, so look, we've been talking a lot about malpractice and about health care, and it's true that 54.5%, that's about almost 1.5 million American families, filed for bankruptcy in 2001. Now, it's my understanding that the bankruptcy bill would make it harder to file for bankruptcy. Can you tell us a little bit about that bill?
This bill has been a push by credit card companies, banking industry, since 1997. It's been around for a long time. Basically, what the bill does is make it much harder for bankruptcy courts to allow individuals to file for Chapter 7, which is the kind of less punitive one where you don't have to pay the full amount. They just liquidate a portion of your assets. Instead, it will impose a means test that forces many more people to file Chapter 13, where you have to pay the full amount at a kind of court-ordered schedule. So
that means no more of the bankruptcy where it's like, I don't know, I just screwed up with my card. Okay, we'll slap on the wrist. Now there's none of those immature indiscretions with money are going to have to be paid back in full.
Well, the problem is it's not just – I mean, the bankruptcy courts would decide – oh, is this some indiscretion? Well, you got to pay the full amount. Now it's taking the power out of bankruptcy courts to make those decisions, and instead, no matter what happened, if it's something you didn't control at all, including medical, you know, some catastrophic medical costs.
Somebody's got to pay, either you or your family.
You still have to pay the full amount under Chapter 13. So as Ted Kennedy says, it kind of makes our bankruptcy courts a collection agency for the credit card companies.
Now, Sam, Senator Chuck Schumer apparently wants to attach an amendment that would exempt medical bankruptcies. Does it have any chance of actually sticking?
Well, possibly. I mean, this is going to be a strange fight in which it's the Democrats don't think there's much of a chance of blocking this, but they're going to try and just kind of throw an avalanche of amendments on it, all sorts of stuff. To try and stop it this week, including what Schumer single-handedly held this bill from passing for the last 5 years, with another amendment of his, which exempts pro-life anti-abortion activists. It's a provision that says any abortion activists who, you know, incur fines through illegal protests can't seek protection through bankruptcy, and that has passed in the Senate for 5 years, but every single year, pro-life conservatives in the House have refused to go off on it, and that's what's held up this bill the entire time. He's going to propose it again this week.
Mm. So let me ask you a question, Sam. What about corporations in terms of this bankruptcy bill applying to corporations? It seems like these guys get away with everything and never have to pay nothing.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, the kind of sweetheart deals that, you know, Enron would seek. Enron, other companies would get protection through bankruptcy, having to pay off, from their malfeasance. There's no real protection for that. This is really targeting individuals.
So really, it has nothing to do with corporations.
No, I mean that's one of the amendments they'll be pushing.
Are they trying to kill us, everybody, Sam? Are they trying to kill us all? I mean, I'm just curious. Do you have any idea? Is that being legislated this week?
It's amazing stuff. Credit card companies have been working very hard at this bill for almost a decade, coming up on a decade now, and they think they're finally going to get it through. There's going to be another big fight through amendments on minimum wage stuff. Ted Kennedy has a $2.10 minimum wage hike he's going to try to amend to this, and Rick Santorum, of all people, is going to have a weaker minimum wage hike to try and counter Ted Kennedy's.
Mm. Now, Sam, the Congress is coming back from its, what do they call it, the midwinter recess?
Right.
Like translated, the week off that they had because of President's Week. Now, the Bush administration is pressuring the governors who are meeting in Washington to either agree on a restructuring plan for Medicaid or possibly face budget cuts, draconian budget cuts in the Congress. Is the Republican-controlled Congress prepared to enact those kinds of very steep and hurtful budget cuts to states where maybe they have allies and certainly members of the same party?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, I think, in all the budget fights this year. It's really, what are the Republican governors? How are they going to play this? The last few years, the Bush administration has try to pass, particularly in Medicaid, that's where a lot of these the state costs have skyrocketed, tried to pass block grant changes in Medicaid structure to shift more of the costs onto the states, and they've managed to block it in part because of, a united front of Republican governor opposition. But there's a real danger this year, and there seems to be some indication, he's meeting with the governors right now, that they're under such stress because of rising medical costs, that they will accept kind of sweeteners in terms of allowing them more flexibility, quote-unquote, to cut services and cut off a lot of people from the program, that they will accept a shift of burden back onto the state. So it's too early to say exactly how this is going to play out in Congress, but that's the role of the Republican governors vis-a-vis Republican Congress and Bush is the real thing to watch this year. And a lot of these, a lot of these changes they can push through without through budget reconciliation, which cannot be filibustered. So that's another factor to think about.
Now, Sam, do you get a sense that they've reached any kind of consensus on Capitol Hill, a bipartisan consensus maybe, that Medicaid is trying to do too much and that's why the costs are rising so fast?
Well, I think that the Republican Party, when it comes to health care, is in just an astounding state of denial. I mean, Bush's – the cover they're giving for Medicaid is – for the cuts they'll make in Medicaid is the old standby, waste, fraud, and abuse. That's what they think they can carve out a huge billions and billions of dollars of cuts that won't affect anybody because it's just, you know, some fraud and some abuse and some, you know, budgetary gimmicks that states are using to get more money.
So are they going to be campaigning with adapt or die in the next election?
Well, they usually come up with better slogans.
Can you briefly tell us about this Faith States initiative bill, the one that's going to allow legal discrimination by faith-based organizations?
Right. This is the Job Training Improvement Act. It's just in the House so far, and it's a bill otherwise about some changes in their the Workforce Investment Act, which is this job training block grant, but. In it is a provision that says, and I quote, exempts religious organizations with respect to their employment of individuals of a particular religion from WIA non-discrimination requirements.
So translate to that.
Translates into if you discriminate on the basis of religion, that's fine. We'll still give you grants. This has been a Bush hobby horse from the beginning in this faith-based initiative. It's never passed in Congress. I don't think it's going to end up passing here, but Bush in 2002, because it stalled in Congress, effectively did the same thing through an executive order.
Is this a bone he's throwing to his religious right base?
Absolutely, and it's mainly cosmetic. They just want to have this fight.
Right.
They like to have the fight of we're on the side of, you know, persecuted, discriminated Christian groups that the government won't include and grant.
Yeah, boy, they got it rough in this country, I tell you, the Christian groups. Yeah, it's really tough for them right now. All right, Sam. So is that's going to be voted on this week? Or?
Yeah, that's coming up this week. In the
All right. Well, maybe we'll check back in with you next week or something, see how this panned out.
Sure.
Okay, buddy. Thanks for talking to us, Sam Rosenfeld.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you. Take care. Yep, you bet. American Prospect website, Sam Rosenfeld. I like talking to that guy. He's a nice guy.
Oh, no, I enjoy talking to him, and he's very, very knowledgeable about these things. I'm wondering, I mean, is this the discrimination thing? That means they could a faith-based organization could deny someone a job because they're Buddhist?
Yeah, sure. It sounds like they can deny them on the grounds of whatever they want.
Hard-shell Baptist versus soft-shell Baptist?
Whatever. Not, you know, even if you're just a secular
Methodist
dude.
Versus Unitarian?
I'm not sure what I believe in. Sorry, you can't work here. We need someone to believe exactly as we do, even if you're just here to cook.
Yeah.
45 past the hour. We're going to be back with another installment from our, you know, over-the-top way too much for us to handle dinner at Daniel, the finest restaurant in New York with food critic Alan Richman. And, what do we get? Maybe the morning remembrance will happen in the next half hour or so. We hear. All right, 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
When I was...
Past the hour, I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, one of the more well-rounded shows on Air America Radio. We mix it up here. Do a little comedy, do some movie talk, do a little book talk. We do some eating out, Mark Riley.
Eating out and eating talk.
This is hilarious. We have this guest on, Alan Richman. He comes on, like, in the first time he's on. We like him. He's a good guy.
Oh, he's good people.
And then he starts talking about how he knows the chef over at Danielle Belloud, who is it's the nicest restaurant in New York. I mean, real high-end. I ate there once on a special occasion with my wife, who is my wife now, Mishna. Saw Sumner Redstone hanging out. I mean, this place is way out of our league. We're like Philistines. You know what I mean? So Richman sets us up over at Daniel. They've got to accommodate Riley's like very sort of specific palate. We got Brendan McDonald, P.W. McDonald's there. Dan Pashman, son of Lucy Linda Pashman, New Jersey, is playing Ed McMahon in this piece. He's the laugh you hear consistently throughout, thank God. But here's another segment from our dinner at Daniel.
Oh, my God.
A mountain of something.
Bread.
It's bread. It's bread. Don't get too nervous. See, the first guy goes for the fanciest bread. I see a man who's going to eat his way out of this meal very early in the meal.
No, he's in for the long haul. You don't know Brendan. He can pace himself.
No.
He's a pro.
He only looks small.
What would you recommend for a fellow who knows how to pace himself, who's a real sophisticate, who understands the danger in eating too much bread?
Someone else coming?
Go ahead.
You know what's amazing, though? That that I'm excited about is that because of the presentation of the canapes, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
And the all the other stuff with the tiered things, I'm literally sitting here going, man, what's going to come out next? You know, how big is it going to be? Are we going to go, ooh, like fireworks?
Well, in a way, the tasting menu at a restaurant sort of replicates the old French banquet, you know, where Louis the whatever would sit down for, you know, half a day and eat, you know, whole peacocks would come out. And one course after another would take 12 hours to eat. So this is sort of a mini version of that. And the idea is...
Do they actually bring puke buckets at the end of the fourth course so you can just stay here?
You're back in Brooklyn, aren't you?
No. I was under the impression that during some of those feasts that were multiple course feasts in the days of old, wherever the hell they were, that kings and royalty would eat to a certain point, get stuff, vomit, and then eat again.
I think that was Roman times. I mean, I don't think it was Louis the 16th. I don't think his clothes were too fine to be
right. What about barfing all over? I'm such an idiot. I'm like, what about Henry VIII? He was an English king, wasn't he?
I'd say now the bread has been down, and this is like a scene out of Les Miserables right now. These guys have gone through so much bread in approximately 3.5 minutes, perhaps less.
It's still going through there.
Yours gone.
I just wanted to taste everything. I tasted the butter roll. Oh, no, they're complete. This plate, I can't see what's on it. See, they do that on purpose. Like, they tilt them up a little bit, so all of a sudden they're like, ta-da!
Yep. Scallops.
Yeah.
Well, you're the scallop. You do eat scallops.
I do eat scallops.
Oh, this is
great. Okay. I thought maybe it was something altogether different.
Riley's in. He's gonna it's going to happen for Mark Riley.
Yeah, it is.
Riley just looked at me one of those faces, went, like he had the full, face.
He looks really happy.
Yeah. The scallops were, see, you know, what people, I think, are used to with scallops are the big, saucer-looking things. Sometimes they taste okay, sometimes they don't. It depends on how they're prepared. But this, it was just like somebody picked this out of the sea. Wow.
I would like to join in this conversation, but nobody shared their scallops with me.
Oh. Okay, well, go ahead.
No, who cares about me, really?
Yeah, he's only the one that brought us.
Oh, okay. Oh, man. Thank you.
That was bad.
Now my wife would recognize me at the table.
Hey, Brendan, maybe Alan's not the right food guy for a...
That's an amazing scallop.
I got the feeling that these scallops were, they felt privileged to give their life for this meal. That these were not unhappy scallops ever.
No, they're very well said.
Alan, what were we talking about? Your book, Fork It Over?
Yes, sir.
We were talking about that. You were thinking these books about food really need to include recipes now. And you thought that your book doesn't have recipes in it. It's basically your appreciation of a range of different foods. And you feel that in the day and age we live in now, that most food books contain recipes. And my question is, do people, by and large, really appreciate food? Are you able to engage them with your writing to where they will open their mind up to appreciate food? I get very limited in my food and what I like. But, like, I would never do this, but I'll tell you something. This is a great experience.
Right. I don't know if people anymore want to read long, you know, flowery food writing. Mm-hmm. Anymore. I don't know if they want to read long writing of anything anymore. So the kind of writing that's in my book, Fork It Over, is really, in a way, it's almost, gosh, I'm going to get in trouble with the publisher for saying this, but it's almost from another age, even though I did it in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
It's the kind of writing that you don't see that much of anymore, the long pieces on food. And they're my adventures in food. But
sure. But
what you really want to have in successful food books today, I'm sorry to say, are recipes. And I'm not sure if anybody ever makes those recipes, but they like to have recipes in the books.
But not even just recipes. Some of them are gearing the recipes towards, you know, specifically not gaining weight, ways to keep trim. So this whole world of food...
That's right.
By and large, in American culture, has been shut down. I mean, I saw an advertisement, you know, pushing a lean diet. It was sponsored by French's Mustard, and it was all about the five flavors of mustard and making, you know, turkey meatballs with oatmeal.
Right.
I eat turkey meatballs with oatmeal.
In America, just by virtue of abiding by, you know, the dietary laws here and unspoken healthy rules, right. If you eat that way, and you're not eating crap all the time, you don't need as much fat. And I find that when you go out and you indulge yourself, like I was in Oaxaca, I was in Tuscany, and by day three, I'm nauseous because they cook with an amount of butter, with an amount of
oil. Well, not in Tuscany. It's probably they're cooking with a lot of oil. You're probably
I know, but even just that amount of oil, eventually, like, you're not used to that. I mean, in Oaxaca, I had no idea that mole was almost completely comprised of pig fat. I had no idea. You know, so I eat a plate of mole, and for 2 days, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm having nightmares about swine attacks. I mean, I was like, it ruined my vacation. And then they tell you afterwards, like Mexican people, they're like, no one eats mole after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. What are you, crazy? I'm like, I didn't know it was a secret potion designed to make people miserable. What kind of food is that? After a certain point in life, you've only got a couple of things that really make life worth living. And one of them is food. The other one is messy. And
but nice work.
It's true, though, isn't it?
Is it okay if we have a good time occasionally, Riley? I think
sure.
We had that was a pretty nice time. Hashman was hilarious. Laughing is... That we can't even describe that meal. We're just trying to share it with you. It's almost going to be impossible to see the presentation of it all. And coming up in future episodes, we're going to hear about Maya sliding down the Great Wall of China. That was one story. We get a flaming fish delivered to the table. Riley's been flawless thus far in the Daniel experience, and we'll see if that continues.
It doesn't.
And we'll see how close our behavior comes to getting us kicked out of one of the finest restaurants in the world. We'll be talking about the Oscars later, about serial killers, about big news coming out of Iraq in a bad way, and also we've got a guest coming up. We've got Stephen Cook, Council on Foreign Relations about the Middle East. It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hi.
Good morning, geniuses. Philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, and of course all you progressive utopians with no sense of humor. We've given you a lot today. Mark Riley and I have been doing the news. We've been doing the job. We've been having the conversations.
Yeah.
Haven't we?
Absolutely.
How you feeling, man? Did you have a good weekend?
I had a good weekend. I regret, however, not having seen the gates in Central Park.
Oh, you now. Know what? I went. I
you
didn't
did
mention
go.
That. I went to the gates. I went to a play. Went out to dinner a couple of times. And my wife in town. My some other family was in town. Why am I honoring this? My dad was in town for a day.
Whoa.
Yeah. You know, I went and saw the gates. I enjoyed them. I thought they were stunning. I really thought they were great.
You know, they have unintended consequences, too. You know, the people that work in and around the park made out like bandits. Hot dog vendors, the carriage guys, they all made one carriage guy said, his business went up 50%.
I'm sure. I felt like it was really provocative. I found it very moving. As I did find the running fence and other stuff like this. I like big art installations at work, and you know, just to see them all in unison. I don't know if in unison they weren't dancing, but the spacing was they all had the same amount of spacing. They were all exactly the same size, and just to see them at all different points in the park, there was something very intentional and very moving about the color, about how many there were, about how synchronized they were. I thought it was great. And a couple of people had gone around to all the sculptures in the park, like of Shakespeare and of...
Yeah,
put an orange in his hand. Like all the sculptures that we saw, someone had gone and taken like an orange and stuck it in their hand or on the sculpture itself. So it sort of became thematic. It was a sort of unintentional... it was very intentional by the people who did it, but it was sort of guerrilla art. They're like,
yeah.
And it almost made the other art in the park seem thematic with the gates themselves.
Incredible.
Of course, my father was like, I wonder what one of these costs. Like one of the gates. How much do you think they get for that? For a gate?
Mm.
Are they going to be selling these? Who the hell makes the money off these gates? And then he said, yeah, I should have bought different shoes. Like a lot on the shoes. But here we go. Let's do this. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So, of course, I just bought myself a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. You know what? I had Brendan tape. See, I so much when I asked him what that sounded like, he told me, and I'm going to use Brendan as the intro from here on out. So let me do this again. So I just bought myself a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. From the New York Times. All right. Press Iran admits it discussed acquiring nuclear technology. There you go. Put that into the machine. Press Iran admits it discussed acquiring nuclear technology. Translation, discussed over discussion leads to non-discussion of discussions. There you go. Here we go from Fox News. Gov's Eye 2008 race, dine with Bush. Gov's Eye 2008 race, dine with Bush. Translation, Incompetent governors get inspiration from former incompetent governor. Sorry, that's out. This is in. Sorry, I just wanted to play it out of context. T.W. McDonald on the intro. From the Associated Press, stag party plan for Prince Charles in New Zealand. Translation, hard partying Kiwis fail to penetrate fun-proof Charles. Strippers and locals leave in disgust. That's that. Hey, wait a minute. I want to do the Brendan outro. All right.
Wow.
So let's get to the Oscars.
There you go. Another blind
shot. I got it in. People have no idea what we're talking about. We have a mound. It's office stuff. Here we go. The complete list of Academy Award winners beginning at the bottom. Not all the way at the bottom.
Close to the bottom.
Here we go. Sound mixing. Scott. No, never mind. Best actress in a supporting role, Cate Blanchett. The Aviator, her portrayal of Katharine Hepburn, made that happen. Actor in a supporting role, got Morgan Freeman, Million Dollar Baby. Thought he did a great job with the assistance of one of those weird kind of, white eye things, because he had one eye was gone, and he had the weird filmy white, that very powerful, that eye. Go ahead. What do you got?
Actress in a leading role. Is that next?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hilary Swank won that for Million Dollar Baby.
Her second one.
Yes, her second one.
She's really good in that. She's got a willingness to be very vulnerable, on screen.
And punched a few times in the head, if you...
Man, you got to see that movie.
I haven't seen it, but I do know it's about boxing.
Yeah, the transition from where it gets, where it's like, yay, to, oh my God, it's brutal.
And, of course, best actor in a leading role, Jamie Foxx for Ray. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see Don Cheadle, but he definitely had it over the other three. Well, maybe not Clint Eastwood. I don't know. I'm still my jury is still out, but that's not going to make a difference, apparently.
Best director, Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
For Million Dollar Baby. And, of course, best picture, Million Dollar Baby.
See that? The Christian Wright couldn't stop that. They were like, here's the trial boom put up there, is that he has no respect for handicapped people who are struggling with their disabilities to live life to the best they can. If it were up to Clint Eastwood, he'd just kill them all or help them kill themselves.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Very, very strange. Absolutely. The rationale for that.
That's the last part you got to. Yeah. So let's get our intern in here. Alon, do you want to come in here and sit
down? Come on in here, Alon.
It's Alon's last day. It's funny. It's his last day and it's his first day on the air.
Yes.
Come on, sit down, Alon. Sit down right there. We got you a card. This is for you. You can read that later.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Well, appreciate it greatly.
Yeah, thank you for helping out. You sound pretty good on the air.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, so what's the big plan from here on out?
I don't know. I'm going to be having a meeting with the manager after the show, as a matter of fact, and we'll be discussing some options.
Here at Air America?
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, so you have a manager?
He's been told we have a manager.
So you might be working here?
That would be great. I'd love to.
Oh, well,
get out.
I thought this was the last day.
Last day as an intern. Give him a break.
All right, buddy. So you might be working here. Well, you got any other options?
I'm talking to a couple of small market radio stations out here. Also may go back to my original field. Who knows?
What's that?
I've been working in computer support for about 10 years.
Really?
He's a hacker. Are you a hacker?
Yeah, more like a network administrator.
Oh.
So how old are you?
Preventing hacking. 38.
Okay. Now, that's an old intern. But
I'm world's oldest intern, officially, according to Guinness.
Now, okay, so you do computer work now. Could you, if I gave you my computer, now all of a sudden I'm getting personal. If I gave you my computer, could you get all the crap out of it?
Absolutely.
Oh,
really?
Why didn't I know that before? Why didn't I know that before? Well, tell us about some of the hobbies, though, the German board games. I heard you talking about German board games.
Oh, actually, okay, it's a thing I've been into for a while. It's a very strategic board games, people. You have four or five people playing them at a time.
Uh-huh.
There's a group I play with up in Connecticut, and it's really a lot of fun. It's sort of an obscure hobby. Probably a lot of people haven't heard of them. Settlers of Catan is one of the very few
Settlers
big
of
names.
Catan. See, now I just glazed over because I just my brain went into a weird nerd alert.
Well, in Germany, the board game designers are like gods.
Okay.
Rainer Kinesia, who's probably one of the big names over there, he's bigger than supermodels.
I'm going to have to find out more about this.
Wait a minute. A German board game maker bigger than a supermodel?
I was about to say.
I just realized that I condescended to an entire subculture, because there are at least four of you in Connecticut that play this thing, and possibly the entire country of Germany, and I don't know anything about it. I'm the ass. You guys might be right.
I go to a convention down in Baltimore every year. There's about 1,000 to 1,200 people that show up.
Wow, that's got
to be a lot of crap.
That's got to be a good time. Huh? All right, I'm kidding. You know what? I have a nerd inside of me, but I try to keep him in there.
I like to think we all have an inner nerd. Yeah. There's just something that brings it out. For me, it's the board games. For Jonathan, it's comic books. Oops, I'm sorry. Jonathan does not have an inner nerd. I apologize for having said that.
Alon, I got to tell you something. Your nerd is out. Alon, your nerd is out. It's not being hidden. You're revealed.
I am a full-fledged geek, I confess.
Okay. Well, thank you for helping us out all this
month. Yeah, thank you, man. We really appreciate it.
How long have you been here? Like 2 years?
Three months.
Since the beginning?
Three months? That's all?
Started December 1.
Wow.
It feels like just yesterday you first got us coffee and cataloged all our comedy bits.
I have been honored to enable your habit of Starbucks.
Oh, thank you. Now, I'm tearing up a little bit. It's 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio. Thanks.
Hey, it's 20 past the hour. Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Morning Sedition. We're having a show. It's Air America Radio. Here comes Dan Pashman with something in his hand. Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, jogging. Good for you, Dan. Good for you, jogging. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'll make note of this. I appreciate all your input. You're doing big work here. Get out. What? We're going to talk to you sometime this week, okay? Okay. All right. See you later. All right, here we go. As people of a grieving nation come together, unfortunately, it's that time of the week again when we hear Morning Sedition. Take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Robert Kearns, inventor of intermittent wipers, dead. Robert W. Kearns, beloved inventor of the intermittent rotating rubber scraper mechanism, responsible for squeegeeing rain off the windshields of millions of automobiles, was found dead at his home last week, completely wiped out. By the time paramedics arrived, Kearns's aged, cracked, and grit-filled body had already left unsightly streaks all over the house. You wearing a new cologne, Mark?
No, man. I don't know what's wrong.
It really makes my nose run.
Sorry, buddy. You need a Kleenex?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
During the last few days of Kearns' debilitating illness, witnesses say the inventor could barely pivot his arms back and forth long enough to wipe himself. Wild hyacinth, right? My eyes are watering so much. Allergies. There's a lot more to this man's life, but those are about all the cheap jokes I can come up with using the words streak and wipe.
You all right?
Yeah, just let me get on with this, all right?
Take your time.
Owen Allred, polygamous leader. Owen Allred, head of one of Utah's largest polygamous denominations, has died. He was 91 and evidently thrived on aggravation. Over his lifetime, he had 8 wives, raised 48 children, and it was estimated to have possessed the country's largest collection of World's Best Dad Who Sleeps With 8 Other Women mugs. Achoo!
You all right?
Yeah. Oh, man.
Maybe it is my cologne.
It could be. Well, is it? Owen's death was announced by his son, Owen Jr. His son, Owen Jr., his other son, Owen Jr., and, of course, his son, Owen Jr. You guys had some french fries in the studio?
No, man.
You pour pepper on that, and yeah, it just, right. My eyes well up, and then I get all kinds of congestion.
You could have been this ficus plant?
Ficus? Oh, you're doing it to me again. Oh, let me get on with it.
Okay.
In a New York Times interview 3 years ago, Allred said, quote, "People have the wrong idea that we're old-time coops who prey on young girls." He added, "I also like my meat well-seasoned, if you know what I mean." You're not going to print that, are you?
What a mess.
Oh.
Wow.
I mean, you got a carpet here with dander in it.
It must be that, yeah.
Allred leaves behind 200 grandchildren and 4 households full of laundry. Laundry. Yeah, I'm all right. Well, this has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Until next week, this is Morton Mortensen saying, "Who's chopping onions?"
You be all right, man?
Yeah, it's just allergies again.
I know. You want me to have a lawn walk you out? Or?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Play that board game.
Wow.
Thanks for coming.
That's all right.
I appreciate it, Mark.
You know, it was all that dust stirred up from Jonathan's comic book collection.
Yeah, it could be anything with you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll be all right?
Yeah, right.
All right. You take care, man.
Sorry I was late this morning.
It's okay, buddy. Well, I'm just glad we got to it, you know.
Unlock me from the, you know, plumbing next time.
I thought someone was going to do that. I thought there was another key. I didn't. All right. We'll see you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Oh, my God.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's what happens. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What? Where do we go? Oh, yes. Well, you know, here, we were talking earlier about this BTK serial killer. This guy was the head of his church, okay? He was the
alleged killer.
I'm sorry.
Even though there is one published report that says he has confessed, he is still alleged.
10 murders. 10 murders. BTK stands for Bind, Torture, and Kill. Classic serial killer. You know, lived in the community, was the head of his church, had a job within the local government. Which was, he was a, what do you call it? Not an an animal compliance supervisor.
Yeah.
Which has to do with a lot of different things, you know, like leashes, dog leashes. Can cats run wild? How many dogs or cats are allowed in the household? How long can my lawn be? This guy had to manage that. So he had, you know, secret, you know, control freak issues, you know, but my thing is here is that this was a church-going guy, community guy, you know, a guy that, you know, represents a conservative trend in Kansas, and he was a serial killer. What was, you know, what was under that percolating id of the conservative Kansas man? And guess who did this? Guess who enjoyed putting firecrackers into frogs, throwing them in the air, and watching them blow up? Guess who? Guess who?
My next door neighbor.
Guess who liked to kill animals when he was a kid, which is one of the symptoms of a serial murderer.
Uh oh.
We'll get back to that. I'll give you the answer after the break. Fair America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley there.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I kind of left you hanging on a question. I was talking about someone we all know that used to stick firecrackers into frogs and blow them up. Someone who had found a great deal of pleasure and excitement out of you know, harming harmless things was our president. This is also a weird, it's a symptom of many serial killers. They found a sort of consistency in a sort of a cruelty to animals that happens very young. And I just, the analogy I'm trying to make is this guy in Kansas who had the facade of he was a church president. He worked for the government. He was a compliance administrator. He was a member of a community. No one suspected that he was out, you know, tying people up, bounding them and killing them, and also, you know, relieving himself on the scene. But from all appearances, you know, he was just a relatively ordinary guy. And I was just drawing an analogy because, you know, our president is personally responsible for overseeing about 153 executions when he was in Texas. God knows how many Iraqis, you know, it all depends on how you look at the screaming, ugly id of the conservative group, the neocon death cult. But let's move on. That gets a little grim. I'll talk more about that later. We have other stuff here. I got on the phone. Look who it is. It's our buddy with the codename Pollux.
Uh-oh.
What's up, Pollux?
Look, Marin, I got important things to say, and I want respect. Don't go saying my code name rhymes with bollocks.
You know that's a British slang for testicles, right?
That's what I mean, okay? This stuff is important.
Okay.
Listen and learn.
Okay, what do you got?
You know about the national ID program?
Yeah. They want to have a national ID card or a driver's license so they can't be counterfeited, right?
Yeah, you know what that's going to mean, right?
Yeah, no more sneaking in the bars with fake IDs you bought over the Internet. Pollux, are you 17?
Look, if anybody knows about me, the better, okay? Investigate.
All right, buddy.
That's my whole point. These IDs are the first step to mandatory biochips.
Biochips? Are those the chips that cause anal leakage?
Idiots! The government is going to implant computer chips in everybody. You won't be able to conduct business or travel or even buy food without the biometrical implant chip. It's the mark of the beast.
Oh, of course, the mark of the beast. I hear you can get that out with a little club soda if you just scrub up.
You stop.
What?
It gets worse. Have you heard about the libido meter?
No, but I never read my junk emails.
Funny. Now, yeah. Excuse me while I save your life.
All right, Pollux.
Listen to this. Israeli scientists?
Yes.
They developed a way to measure sexual arousal by recording your brain waves.
Pollux, baby, it's not hard to measure sexual arousal in guys. It's like eighth grade when you had to go up and write on the blackboard and you had that tentpole erection. You know what I'm saying?
Who told you about that?
I meant in general, Pollux. All right?
I knew that.
Okay. All right. No, wait. I think everything makes sense all of a sudden, Paul.
Huh?
Yeah. You're basically saying the government issues mandatory national ID cards, which the terrorism-weary people meekly accept. Once the sheep population is accustomed to the IDs, the government introduces the biochip, which keeps tabs on everybody electronically. Then, with the libido meter, they can even track exactly what turns each people on sexually. And the government agent somewhere monitors your libido constantly, waiting for an erotic alarm to sound.
What was that?
Pollux, it seems that you've already been tagged.
So, oh, man.
Yeah, try not to think about anything that could possibly arouse you.
What? Don't say that. I gotta get out of here.
Oh, wow. All right. There's that guy.
Till next.
Yeah. So in the studio, having to put up with our childish antics is
a man in a tie.
A next generation fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations who's sitting here going, why am I doing the show? When I do one on the phone, I don't have to sit through this stuff.
I just want to know you guys aren't going to ask me to come to the board or anything like that, right?
No.
The blackboard. Okay.
No.
Okay, yeah.
You can sit right there. He's a Middle East policy expert. Stephen Cook joins us in the studio right now. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
So there's a lot of, you know, horrendous bad news, as usual, out of Iraq. 125 people, possibly more, were killed in a series of suicide bombs. Now, what is unfolding there? Do you see, like, is there going to, what are the chances, first of all, before we get into the politics, a chance of civil war in after this election?
I think the elections went off pretty well as, you know, some of the people in the field suggested, but of course, it was really only the Shia and the Kurdish community that were voting. And it's clear that the insurgency is intent on fomenting sectarian and ethnic violence in Iraq. I don't know how much longer people like the Shia, who have been the targets of these kinds of attacks, are going to take it. They maintain militias, as do the Kurds. So I think the metaphor for Iraq going forward, maybe, and let me stress maybe, Lebanonization, and not the Lebanon of today. I mean the Lebanon of the mid-1970s through the 1980s.
What does that mean?
Well, Lebanon went through a 15-year period of civil war in which the various ethnic and religious communities went at each other. And that ended, of course, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, with Syria's occupation of Lebanon.
Yes.
Of course, the Lebanese are now demanding the Syrians get out. But you now have religion and ethnicity being the key political marker in Iraq.
Now, we're seeing in this bombing, part of a recurring pattern in terms of it taking place as people gathered to take physicals for the police department, for Iraq's police and security forces. Is this a strategy that the insurgents, at the very least, can accomplish the end of keeping people out of a collaboration on that level?
Well, it's clearly the goal of the insurgency to disrupt the building of Iraqi security forces, and they seem to be doing a fairly good job of it. The United States is pouring ever more money into the training of security forces in order to hasten the American military's withdrawal from Iraq. But as long as this goes on, you're going to find less and less people who are willing to sign up for this very dangerous and hazardous duty. It's even before they get on duty. It's when they're just signing up. There was some hope after the elections that with relatively peaceful elections and a political process underway, that people would be more willing to join the security forces. But as these kinds of bombings continue, because the police stations and the gathering points really are soft targets, there is some concern that less and less people will be inclined to take part.
It's certainly not going to hasten the Americans leaving. It's going to guarantee that they probably stay there longer.
Well, that's the catch-22. The longer we stay, the longer the violence continues, because the insurgency is able to ramp up on the question of an American occupation and collaboration. But if the United States leaves, it leaves a country that is virtually indefensible to this relatively small group of insurgents.
Now, let's talk about what this government means. What does the United Iraqi Alliance, what do they believe in, what do they stand for, what is our relationship going to be with them?
Well, the United Iraqi Alliance is the largest block that won the largest number of seats in the elections on January 30th, and they're going to be the ones who are going to dominate the government. The gentleman who's been selected to try to form a government, Ibrahim Jafari, is someone who is a religious gentleman. He has ties to Iran. He went into exile for many, many years. I think that the United States is hoping, because the Shia, the United Iraqi Alliance, which is composed primarily of Shia, but there are some Kurds and Sunnis that are part of it, will have to reach across ethnic and sectarian boundaries to establish a government. That is, they'll need compromise, they'll need to bring Kurds in, because they don't control two-thirds of the new National Assembly. On one hand, I'm a bit hopeful about that, because they didn't win a two-thirds majority, that they'll be forced to compromise. At the same time, I think the three major communities in Iraq have very different political demands, and I don't see where the room for compromise is. There were reports yesterday that the Kurds are determined not to relinquish their 100,000-strong militia known as the Peshmerga. The Shia in the south have their own militias and are starting to wonder, why do they need the problems of the rest of Iraq? They can build a Dubai south of the Euphrates, mm-hmm, without the Sunni triangle, the Anbar province, and the problems of Kurdish drive for independence. So we'll have to see going forward. The Shia are determined to undermine any Kurdish desire to veto provisions within a new constitution. The transition administrative law, this gets into some kind of inside baseball about the details of constitution building in Iraq, but the transition administrative law, which was signed last March, gave the Kurds the right to veto parts of the constitution that they didn't feel upheld their autonomy. The Shia are determined to oppose that kind of thing. So there is the strong possibility that you're going to have ethnic and sectarian conflict in Iraq.
Now, I know that there was a big New York Times piece last week about the Kurds' desire to see Arabs driven out of Kirkuk. And, of course, Saddam Hussein actually tried to Arabize, if that's a word, Kirkuk in the past. And, of course, there's a lot of oil sitting underneath there.
Right.
How realistic is the Kurdish desire to get to literally move Arabs out of the city?
Can we do that? Let's address it after
Yeah,
the break.
Let's do that after
the
break.
And we'll put it all together. It's 43 past the hour. We are now talking to Stephen Cook. He's a next generation fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, obviously about Iraq, Iran, and perhaps Egypt if we have time after the break. It's 43 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
If. 6:48 past the hour. Let's see if we can find the runway here. It's about to snow, I think, out there. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition. We're talking to a next generation fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, Stephen Cook, about the never-ending amount of topics that have to do with the Middle East. But let's get back to your question and try and get back into Iraqi. We are in it.
Well, yeah. And my question is, you know, does Stephen think that the Iraqi government, once it's constituted, will really go after the insurgents the way Hosni Mubarak did in Egypt in the mid-1990s?
I think that's the signals that we're getting from Ibrahim Jaafari if he, in fact, becomes the prime minister. He is someone who wants to increase the de-Baathification. He was opposed to Iyad Alawi's bringing Baathists back into the government to administrate the country. He wants to increase that. He believes it's a dead-ender for Iraq for the Baathists and the Sunnis to come back. And he wants to very much ramp up military security operations against the insurgency. And he wants to use both Iraqi and American forces to do that.
So you don't see that there's no chance the American forces are ever leaving?
Well, people talk about 18 to 24 months, but as long as this violence continues, I don't see how the United States is able to really withdraw in a major kind of way. People are talking about, well, we're going to bump up against the 2006 midterm elections, and there's going to be a lot of political pressure within the Republican Party to withdraw. But I can't see how you could call Iraq a success if there's a continuing insurgency even at that late date and withdraw troops, and it could be a good outcome.
And what do you think? Like, I saw a report this article about how they resisted having Saturday off because it was a Jewish holiday. Now, what is the tone going to be around Israel and around Sharia in terms of how they're going to, not that the two are, well, they're not, well, they are exclusive on some level, but what do you think the feeling is towards Israel and towards theocratic rule in Iraq?
I don't think there's going to be a theocratic rule. It's clear that Ibrahim Jaafari is someone who feels very strongly about Islam. Some people have described him as an Islamist and who has close ties to Iran. But I think the Iraqis are actually quite different from the Iranians in many ways and learn their lessons from their co-religionists in Iran. They see that the Iranian revolution has petered out, and you really just have an authoritarian system there like any other authoritarian system. People are making a big deal of the fact that the United Iraqi Alliance wants to have Islam be a primary component of the Iraqi constitution. The fact remains, if you read many Arab constitutions, many of which don't really have much meaning, but they do place Islam as a central component to legislation. They look to Islamic jurisprudence as the source of law. So I'm not terribly concerned about that. I think the real issue going forward with Iraq is the political markers are going to be ethnic and sectarian, and I think that that's potentially dangerous.
Now, Iran has been very, very vocal in its condemnation of the State of Israel. Do you expect Iraq to have that same kind of tone to their dealings with Israel?
I think there was some hope after the invasion and that there would be an installation of a new government in Iraq that was more moderate and Western-oriented, that there would be some sort of compromise between the Iraqis and the Israelis. And I don't foresee that happening. In fact, a previous Iraqi minister in the interim government actually visited Israel. He was censured and removed from his post. So I don't see much movement on that front. I think the best thing that can happen is there to be progressive development on the Israeli-Palestinian front. I think the Arab world has signaled that if there is change there and the Palestinians come to some sort of compromise with Israel, it won't be long before the wider Arab world comes to some sort of compromise with Israel.
Is there any significance in your mind behind the fact that we've heard absolutely nothing since John Negroponte was essentially called home about who his replacement would be? Have you heard about who the Bush administration is looking at?
Well, not to be terribly cynical about it, but would you want to be the U.S. ambassador to Iraq? I think that it's a very sensitive issue, and it's a sensitive post, and they want to have someone with tremendous diplomatic and political skill there, and that's someone that John Negroponte quite honestly had. He's now come home for the Herculean task to become the first director of national
intelligence.
Czar, exactly. So I think they're weighing who would be best in that post.
Now, what do you think is going on with this Hosni Mubarak announcing that they're going to have democratic elections in Egypt? What are the politics of that, and how much will that change Egypt, and will it change it?
Well, a little bit of background here. While the Iraqis were electing representatives to a new National Assembly, the Egyptians were out arresting opposition leaders. And the president picked out Egypt as an example in his State of the Union address, and then his inaugural address.
Uh-huh.
Could be a leader of democracy, but the Egyptians have actually been moving backwards. And there's been a lot of pressure, both internally on Mubarak. He's been in power for almost 25 years now, and there's a small but growing movement of people who are saying, enough, enough, let's move on to new leaders.
New guy,
new free and open elections. So over the weekend, he announced that there would be free and open elections. Most of my Egyptian friends that I've spoken with since then suggest that this is actually just a charade to relieve the pressure both internally and externally. They point out that the Egyptian parliament, which is dominated by the ruling party, will still have to approve, quote-unquote, serious candidates. And at this point, you know, with the 2005 elections that will come next fall, there's really little chance that if Mubarak decides to run, which is very likely, that he's going to face any kind of serious competition. Plus, people are concerned that he is grooming his son, Gamal Mubarak, to become the president. His son has a more progressive outlook, but if he was to just parachute in, that would be an inherently anti-democratic act.
But I thought the interesting thing in the piece I read was that, you know, they will have democratic elections, but, you know, they will not have term limits.
Right, exactly. You know, he's talked about altering Article 76 of the Egyptian Constitution, but not Article 77, which allows a president to serve as long as 25 years, like Hosni Mubarak has done. He doesn't even have a vice president. So this is a good first step, but it's a baby step.
He's the only guy in the ballot.
It's not even a ballot. He's nominated by the parliament, and then Egyptians go for a referendum, and they can say either yes or no. One of the things you have to recognize, though, even with this new and positive development, is that Arab countries like Tunisia and Algeria have multiple candidates for presidential elections. They don't really mean anything, though.
Now, next time Condoleezza Rice is in the Middle East, do you think she'll stop by Egypt? She refused to go because of the jailing of one of the most prominent dissidents. Next trip, she goes and talks with Mubarak, you think?
Well, this is clearly, the announcement is clearly calculated to drain U.S. pressure from the Mubarak regime. He's been making nice noises about Arab-Israeli conflict. This is another move. He wants to relieve that pressure, so if the administration decides it's worth it, they'll go. But this administration seems to be set on pressuring the Egyptians on political reform. So we'll have to see going forward.
Stephen Cook, thank you so much for joining us.
Definitely, thank you.
Stephen Cook is a Next Generation Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Very informative. Like, I feel like we could talk all morning about this stuff.
Yeah.
It never ends. So, okay, there's the sound of the fax machine. That's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today. One, urge Clint Eastwood to issue this press release. If Bush's Social Security plan goes into effect, a $1 million baby born today will only be worth about $100,000 at retirement age. Two, don't forget, just because Jamie Foxx and Morgan Freeman won last night, that doesn't make everything okay. The man is still winning. Three, during the relentless post-Oscar coverage, encourage entertainment shows to ask Hillary Swank at least one question about the Kyoto Treaty. Four, remind everyone you meet today of how many tsunami, why do I keep saying that? Tsunami victims could be fed for the price of Kate Blanchett's dress. Five, today's phrase, just whip it into conversation. Hope you enjoyed the Oscars, man. It's the last one you'll ever see. Next year, Hollywood will be under martial law, so goodbye, Oscar. And the winner is fascism. Wake up, sheeple. They're already building media-free camps in Arizona. All right. Thanks again, Stephen Cook, Mark Riley.
What do we got
tomorrow? Anything great?
Tomorrow, Todd Barry is back in the house.
Very funny.
Yeah. His latest comedy CD is called Falling Off the Bone.
Yes.
We'll talk about that and much more with him tomorrow. It's been fun, Maron.
It has, Riley. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. Same bat time, same bat channel.
Yeah, okay.
Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition.